speak to him loud.
Aha!
This is the World Vision Report.
Ladies and gentlemen.
In Sudan, the talk on the street is whether elections are going to heal the country or lead to the secession of the South. And in Zimbabwe, a courageous woman who was raped as a child helps other young women get past their trauma.
If a girl is raped, there must be an action that she puts together with her peers. So in other words, we are transforming victims into survivors and then into leaders walking in the fullness of their potential.
And it's tax time, but in some countries like Mexico, tax evasion is so much part of the culture, well, it's almost like a sport.
La economía informal.
You've got the famous bullfighters, they're called. They lay out their products on a cloth on the ground. When the inspector comes, they just whip up the cloth like a matador and run away.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Waymire. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The first multi-party elections in 24 years have just taken place in Sudan. The elections were part of the peace agreement that ended the civil war between the Muslim North and the Christian oil-rich South. Most believe that President Omar al-Bashir will hold on to his seat. But what the Sudanese are watching most closely in this election is whether or not it will open the door to a future referendum that would allow southern Sudan to secede and gain its independence. That's something the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement wants. Reporter Trevor Snapp is in Sudan covering the elections. Thank you so much for joining us, Trevor.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've been in southern Sudan all week for the elections. What's the mood there?
I would say festive in a sense. At least the first day when I went out, it was a real celebration. It was a Sunday, so everybody was dressed in their finest clothes. The roads were packed full of lorries bringing people back to their villages. Every bus was full. Getting out of Juba was almost impossible for a lot of people because everybody was going home to vote. You know, when they got back to their village, it was, I think, a pretty unique situation because you had so many people returning, seeing their families for the first time. We saw some lost boys that had come back from Kenya. And so the whole country has been pretty festive, but it hasn't gone entirely smoothly.
What, the elections haven't gone smoothly? There's been a lot of talk about fraud and corruption.
When you're on the ground and when you're out in the field at these polling stations, it's such a logistical, Herculean task to get all these ballots out to these really remote villages under really poor infrastructure. And where you have a very uneducated and illiterate population that has been only used to war. So there is definitely room for fraud in that, but at the same time, a lot of, I think, the problems and the chaos at the polling stations could also be attributed just to the difficulty of organizing something like this for the first time in 20 years.
Are the people at all confident that these election results will be legitimate?
The fear is not about elections being rigged so Bashir wins or loses. The fear is more that somehow, in the South at least, that somehow the North is going to rig these elections so the SPLM, which is the political arm of the SPLA, will not have the political figures to move ahead with the referendum. These elections are really for the South about the referendum, and for the North, for Bashir to basically legitimize his power.
And let's talk about the referendum. Even though all of the major political offices, and including the presidency, are up for grabs in this election, there's this referendum that's out there a year away. But that's what people in the South are really looking at.
Yeah, and the referendum is the most important thing that will happen to Sudan in its recent history. South Sudan could potentially become an independent country. And that's something that people here are very enthusiastic about. They feel like once they're independent, the North can't manipulate them, the North can't persecute them, it can't wage war against them. That may or may not be true, but what is true is that the South is completely dedicated to having a referendum and most likely voting for independence.
Who is mostly opposed to a proposed secession? I would assume it would be political parties in the North.
Yeah, but you know what? It was really bizarre because actually during the campaign season, Bashir was in the South campaigning for president, and he was saying, I'm for the referendum, I'm for independence. If you want to be independent, I'll support secession. So he was openly saying that when he was campaigning in the South. In the recent weeks, he's been threatening that he might make that process difficult if the political forces in the South don't kind of do what he wants. But at this point, it's really difficult to say what he will do in January.
You talked about some of the atmosphere at the polling places and just the jubilation on the streets. I understand there's even been some music written for the elections. What are you hearing?
For the last year or two, there's been a growing number of Sudanese musicians who are returning from refugee camps or who are kind of used to be maybe child soldiers or lost boys and are coming back and are seeing music as a way to unite the country. And so these musicians have been writing songs about the elections, about responsibility, about peace, about unity. And one of the songs that I really like is called Call the President. It's written by a musician called Lam. And this song is all about taking responsibility and how everybody should be their own president. And if they are, then there will be, you know, a country that will change from a conflict zone into a legitimate country. Speak to him,
Lam. And I think we'll go out on that song. Trevor Snapp from Juba, Sudan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Take care. One day to be the president, dedicated to all leaders around the world and the youth in Africa. Give me one day to be the new president. Show you what the youth our future defend. Give me one day to be the new president. Show you what the youth our future defend.
You've been listening to the Sudanese singer Lam Tunwar singing his election song, Call the President. Sudan is the largest country in Africa and one of the most diverse. The swampy, oil-rich south is mostly Christian and animist. In the north, Muslim Arabic speakers live in the dry desert lands. Reporter Heba Ali spent some time in the north. That's where she learned to make do without electricity. She brought us this story on a day in the life of a family in the village of Al-Titi.
It's barely morning when I arrive outside a spacious mud home in this sandy village. Like all the others here, it's painted white but has no roof. I open the big blue metal gate to the home's front entrance. Basically an empty open space with bare mud walls. 16-year-old Sara greets me shyly, still dressed in her pajamas. Her mother, a widow, has already been up a half hour. They have no alarm clock. They don't need one. The Muslim call to prayer and the chicks that run free across her sandy, pebbled floor are enough of a wake-up call. Anything moves and I wake up, says Mother Zainab Abu Bakr, Mursi Abu Bakr, including the sound of the birds. I watch as Abu Bakr breaks corn off cobs and feeds the chicks. She has a thin frame and a long face, with scars along each cheek, tribal marks from her youth. Abu Bakr is known in the village by her nickname, Bertoda, which means little girl. But although she's only 40, she looks much older. She lives without electricity. Everything she does by hand. As she puts it, this exhaustion ages us. You'll get tired with me today, she warns. I tell her not to worry, but I wonder just what a day without electricity will entail. The first point of order is the morning tea. Bertoda throws a few twigs onto the fire and boils water in a pot. But after several minutes, the leisure comes to an end. Come on, drink your tea so we can go, she tells me. The day is just about to begin. Bertoda releases a dozen sheep from a side gate and pushes them along with a stick. She leads them to fields a few kilometers away to graze. She makes a bit of money by occasionally selling one of the animals. She also does some farming and gets money from her son who works abroad. We reach the fields along the Nile River. Bertoto wades in to fetch the animals some water. The fields are just as quiet as the village. No tractors and very few mechanized pumps. Then she cuts a bunch of shrubs, ties them together, and carries them on her head. This serves as feed for the animals during the winter months. By 10 a.m., the sun is grueling, and Bertoda heads back to the village. Hot and tired when she gets home, she wants nothing more than a glass of cold water. The water is hot, she says, pointing to a set of clay pots in the shade of her home. There's no nice water, Bertoda continues. These clay pots are not like a refrigerator. Down the street, an ice seller hawks his product through a loudspeaker. But Bertoda can't afford the blocks of ice. Two of her children have grown up and moved out, but she still needs to put Sara through school. Ice is not her priority. Daughter Sara draws water from the well with a jerry can. She'll boil the water to make a late breakfast of beans. Isn't it heavy, I ask, as we walk back to the kitchen?
That wouldn't.
We're used to it, she answers with a smile. Sara, like other children here, is accustomed to responsibility. And except for the occasional soccer game, there are few diversions. No computer games, no children stuck to the TV for hours.
Hello.
Bertoda and Sara do have a cell phone, but to charge it, they have to stop by the neighbor's house. Some villagers have private generators they turn on at night. After breakfast, mother and daughter sit in the shade, chatting and fanning themselves with rags. The rest of their day is filled with errands, visits to friends and family, and sometimes just sitting around in silence. For me, the quiet and tranquility is refreshing, but for Sara, who lives it every day, it's another matter. What will we do with this tranquility, she says. What good is this tranquility for us? They say electricity is coming to us soon. They say that every year. As the sun sets, Sara lights a candle, and once again, tea is prepared. The family eats a dinner of beans, falafel, cheese, and bread by moonlight. They turn on a flashlight only when needed. Then, as her day ends, Bertoda says her nightly prayers, thanking God for all she has. For the World Vision Report, I'm Hiba Ali in El Teiti Village, Northern Sudan.
Coming up, it's tax time, but not for the thousands of street vendors selling their goods in Mexico. That story after a short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In Mexico, only a fraction of the population pays their taxes. In fact, Mexico's tax revenue is only about 8 or 9% of its GDP, one of the lowest in the world. That's because much of the country's economy is informal, made up of street vendors who earn small sums every day and are notoriously tricky to tax. Conrad Fox reports from Banderilla in southern Mexico.
It's about 10 o'clock in the morning, and business is already going well at the stall of Esteban Cortez. He sells an odd combination of sandals and hotcakes. Competition is stiff in the sandal business these days, with more and more people turning to street selling to make a living. So a few years back, he added a skillet and started selling the popular snack as well. He says it was hard to admit that footwear sales just weren't cutting it.
At first I felt kind of embarrassed. It's like you've stepped down in the world, you know? Your clients laugh at you, your friends, your family, but then they see it's a good business. Well, now, embarrassed? Me? They all want my recipe.
There's something else he's not embarrassed about either.
I'm a tax evader. I've never paid and I never intend to.
And neither do most of the estimated 20 million other street vendors in Mexico. Jorge Smecki is a professor of business administration at Mexico City's Iberoamericana University. He says street vendors like this one have been a blessing and a curse for Mexico.
The informal economy is like a social shock absorber, because the formal economy doesn't create enough new jobs every year. But the problem is, it's not taxed. There's no system. A typical market is 500 stalls, and they're not always the same. How do you know who's there? You've got the famous bullfighters, they're called. They lay out their products on a cloth on the ground. When the inspector comes, they just whip up the cloth like a matador and run away.
And that, he says, means about $3 billion in lost tax revenue for the country. The
truth is, very few Mexicans are paying taxes. It makes the country unsustainable. There's no way 30% of us can pay for the other 70%.
Today, some 40% of the country's tax revenue comes from the state-owned oil company. But many analysts predict Mexico's oil and the taxes that go with it could run out in just 10 years. That has politicians scrambling to tax street sellers. They implemented a simplified version of the country's tax system for small business people like street vendors, charging a flat fee of about $22 every 2 months. But Esteban Cortez, the vendor who sells hotcakes, says even that is too much.
No recibimos ningún beneficio.
We don't get anything for it in return. We've got no place to sell, no social security. Sure, taxes pay for stuff like hospitals, but have an accident and see how much they charge you for an operation.
Doña Jolie earns about $400 a month selling food at the same market as Cortez. She says that when a family member gets sick, she has to go from stall to stall asking for help.
It's in God's hands. What the other sellers will chip in is all you've got.
She says she does pay her taxes, but only grudgingly.
It's not fair. I've got to pay property tax, electricity, water. I come here in a taxi, and imagine how much is left for me in the end. Nothing.
Mexico's president, Felipe Calderón, has vowed to find a way to make street vendors pay taxes. But Cortez says it'll have to be politicians that make the first move. They're so corrupt, he says. Why should I pay my taxes just so they can steal the money? For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Banderilla, Mexico.
Years ago, Zimbabwe gained its independence from Britain. The country was once considered the breadbasket of Africa, but today its economy is in ruins and people are dependent on food aid. The breakdown of Zimbabwe has led to an epidemic of child abuse, and that's of great concern to Betty Makoni, the founder of the Girl Child Network in Zimbabwe. Betty Makoni spoke to us from London, where she's currently living in exile.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Peggy.
Why has rape become such a big problem in Zimbabwe?
Rape has become a big problem because of the lawlessness where the justice system collapsed, the economic situation where parents are going out to look for money and nobody's looking after the children, and this myth that scares every girl and that puts their lives at risk is that when a man who is HIV positive has sex with a virgin girl, he can be cured of HIV and AIDS. And I think this belief is with 1 in 10 men in the country.
Is there an estimate on how many girls in Zimbabwe are victims of rape?
Oh, definitely. I started my project in 1998. So from 1998 up to 2008, we handled over 35,000 cases of girls being raped. But on an annual basis, the rape cases that we recorded annually were almost 6,000.
6,000 girls being raped a year?
Those are the only ones who report. There could be many thousands who have gone on quiet.
Betty, I understand this topic is very personal for you, that you had a traumatic experience as a young girl.
As a young girl growing up in the high-density suburb of Chitungwis, I used to be a vendor at night. And while I went out venting, was to find a way to help my mother because I wanted her to get bus fare to run away from domestic violence. So I used to move around with a group of young girls. We were all the same age, but I was the youngest, almost turning 7 years. A man lured us into a house. So my friend Lucky, myself, and even 8 other girls, we were all raped over a long period of time. And when it was discovered, he was actually exposed, but he was never taken to court, he was never taken to police. And I still remember the pain I went through when my mother tried to conceal everything because she was in domestic violence.
So you told your mother you had been raped, and she told you not to tell anybody?
My mother concealed it, and now as I grew up, I understood why. If she had opened up, she could have been in a worse-off situation. And you know, during the time like 1977, 1978, rape was something that brought more shame to the family and the girl than to the perpetrator.
How do you feel, Betty, that your experience affected you as a young woman?
My own experience actually changed my career. Even though I was meant to be a teacher, I always wanted to act like a lawyer seeking justice. I always wanted to act like a policeman knocking on the door of a rapist to say, come out to the jail. I always wanted to act like a magistrate who gives a sentence to a man who has raped. I didn't manage to be the three things that I wanted to be. Then I set up an organization called the Girl Child Network, where I became an activist. What's so exciting about what I am doing with all my heart and all my energy is I've got the magistrate, I've got the police, I've got social services, all of them pulled together to assist a little girl. When a little girl smiles, mission accomplished. I'm not looking for anything more.
What exactly does your organization do for these girls?
We give them basics like school fees, uniforms, shelters from violence. And we also facilitate platforms like girls' clubs where they come to meet, discuss issues affecting them, but most importantly, not to talk about the problem, but to talk to the problem. If a girl is raped, there must be an action that she puts together with her peers. If she's out of school, all girls come together in solidarity to make sure that she's reinstated. So in other words, we are transforming victims into survivors and then into leaders walking in the fullness of their potential.
You have 700 girls' clubs and you have 3 villages. Tell us a little about the villages. How are they set up and how does it work for the girls?
Girls' empowerment villages are like one-stop center for a girl, especially those in rural areas who do not have access to any services. When a girl comes to the empowerment village, they get to see a counselor. They get referral to police, to the courts, to hospital in the cases where they are sexually abused. Girls also come to organize to meet with women role models, women who have actually made it to top careers, who want to inspire young girls with their stories. We claimed the space for girls because this concept existed in the Makoni tribe where I come from 400 years ago, where traditional chiefs reserved places for the princesses from the Makoni royal family. What I simply did was just to blend the traditional positive cultural practice with the modern human rights practice to make it the empowerment village for girls.
I imagine it would be difficult to measure the success of your program. And how would you measure success?
Peggy, no program is 100% perfect, but I can say 60% of what I wanted to achieve, I've got it. I've got traditional leaders transformed into activists who defend women's rights in 10 districts. It means we are covering almost a population of 2 million people out of the 13 million people we have. And if 2 million people are thinking gender equality, it means it's a new total era for women and girls. All chiefs in Zimbabwe are giving us pieces of land to build girls' empowerment villages. That must be applauded. Then when I'm looking at victims, our program, yes, has been successful, maybe 50%, because we have managed to take them out of the situations. But sometimes we get them not treated on time, they don't get justice, they get frustrated, and that can also be a setback. But to a greater extent, I've seen many more smiles than the time when I grew up. They are emerging doctors, they are lawyers, police officers, in areas where they can be of service to other girls. I can see a victim coming to shake your hand to say, I'm here because of you, Betty. A victim transformed into a survivor.
What's been the response in Zimbabwe among the leadership in the country to your work?
Amongst the parents of the young girls I've assisted and amongst community leaders who have seen the work on the ground, I remain their hero. They are so grateful. And that's the constituents of the poor people I represent. But also, I become controversial when I deal with cases of high-profile people, high politicians, whether they are from the opposition party or from the ruling party. What I've seen is that people don't want to be exposed. People don't want women to challenge them. I've managed to stand up to one high-profile person who actually took a knife up to the court where I was escorting a girl he had raped. So I've seen it all. I've been beaten. I've been arrested. Why? Because you point to somebody who is politically and economically powerful. They've got all machinery to actually hit you back.
I understand that you are in exile in London because your life was actually in danger.
Definitely, when I saw myself being targeted, having done some high-profile cases, it was really dangerous to get your house. And the last time I left Zimbabwe, I ran away from death threats. I ran away from men who stalked me wherever I went, like somebody under surveillance. And the thing that I hated most was to be arrested, interrogated, and politicized. I was simply there to save the young girls. That was not understood. And when I felt it coming, somebody advised me undercover to pack and go. Yes, you love your work, but this time, just go, Betty.
Betty Makoni is founder of Girl Child Network in Zimbabwe. Betty, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peggy. It's a pleasure to talk to you. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Betty Makoni and the Girl Child Network have helped rescue 35,000 abused girls in Zimbabwe. Oliver Mutukudzi is Zimbabwe's most famous musician. He sings about some of the problems, like domestic abuse, that are rampant in Zimbabwe. We'll hear some of his music a bit later in the show, but first, reggae star Bob Marley was the highlight of Zimbabwe Independence Day celebrations in 1980. Now, 30 years later, the family of the deceased singer will be appearing at a concert to celebrate the anniversary. Here's some of their music. This song is called I Love You Too.
I love you too, I love you too. I tell you I love you, I love you too, I love you too. When you smile, I'll smile along. When you cry, my comfort comes. When you walk, I'll be beside you, holding your hands. When the sun come out, we play. I'll never be far away. When you tell me that you love me, this is what I'm gonna say. I love you too, I love you too. I tell you I love you. The fish loves the sea, like the honey and the bee, like a lizard loves to climb up into a tree, like a bird loves to fly.
That's the Marley family, Ziggy, Rita, and Sadella from the album Family Time. They're part of the 30th anniversary celebrations in Zimbabwe going on this week. You can hear music from one of Zimbabwe's own musicians a bit later in the show. Stay tuned for that. I tell you, I love you. Reporter Laura Sparrow lives in New York City, but she travels to Nepal every year. There, a single winding road connects Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, to the popular city of Pokhara. Laura's made the 7-hour bus trip between Kathmandu and Pokhara many times, and she always keeps a recorder on hand. She says you never know when something surprising might happen. Here's Laura's reporter's notebook.
Sometimes I'll be sitting in the subway here in Manhattan, listening to the random music shuffle on my iPod. And suddenly this recording that I made a few years ago will come on. All at once, I'm back on a jaw-rattling bus ride from Kathmandu to Pokhara, winding in and out of the hills on a narrow road. I was watching terraced rice fields rush past the window, cascading like waterfalls down to the Trishuli River. When all of a sudden, apparently out of nowhere, a boy jumped onto the bus with his 3-string fiddle. He looked about 11. I get tired of the endless march of vendors and performers hoping for a few rupees. So I turned back towards the window. But when he started to play an abrasive and forthright rendition of one of Nepal's most popular songs, something made me turn back around. There was something about this kid that I couldn't stop watching. Other than the song choice, there was nothing that was meant for the benefit of the audience. As far as I could tell, he wasn't even trying to sound good. The performance was purely functional. For all his enthusiasm, the only point was to play loud enough and long enough to hold up his end of the bargain. And it sounded so bad, it was totally appealing. Which is why, when he was done, a passenger near me reached into his pocket and said, Okay, what's it gonna be? And then everyone dropped coins and wadded up bills into the boy's small bag, because that was our end of the bargain. I gave him 20 rupees. I can still see him with his earnings, jumping out of the bus into the deserted road, and we drive on through the hills towards Pokhara. Now I think I should have paid him more for this keepsake, which years later still appears out of nowhere and catches me in a New York City subway car, where there's nothing in the speeding window but my reflection.
Laura Sparrow is a freelance journalist who lives in New York City. We head to Haiti next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Haiti is still in ruins, but you can find a little joy rising up from the ashes. Grant Fuller brings us a story from Port-au-Prince about a street vendor who brings happiness to people, one cup of shaved ice at a time.
In the street next to the National Palace, a crowd closes in on Juve Pierre at work. He's the eccentric star of this show, along with his colorful cart. Pierre sells cups of shaved ice, a sugary treat Haitians call fresco. In the middle of the madness, Pierre uses a metal scoop with a blade on it to shave a large block of ice for his long line of anxious customers.
I'm surrounded everywhere I go. There's laughter, and I feel awesome about it. I never thought I would have a crowd. I never thought that people would want to buy from me so much, or that they'd laugh so much. It's really a weird feeling, but I like it.
The beauty of Pierre's business is not so much in what he sells. There are fresco vendors on every corner downtown, but it's the way he sells it. First of all, his cart is actually a 6-foot-long wooden boat on wheels. And strangely enough, 4 old phones hang from the side of the boat. It's all part of the creative ordering process at Pierre's ice cart, which he's named Fresco Catalina.
The first step, you look up at the boat and you see a phone assigned to each color of ice.
Frescos aren't ordered by flavor, but by color. Pierre offers green, white, yellow, and red.
You pick up the phone for the color that you want, You hold it to your ear and say,
Allô, Catalina, c'est mon fresco.
Hello, Catalina? That's my fresco you're shaving.
That's where the laughter comes in. Customers get a kick out of listening to each other pick up the fake phone and recite the required phrase. And to top it all off, Pierre wears a ridiculous outfit. Blue hospital scrubs, rubber gloves, and the most bizarre part, a lacrosse helmet adorned with headphones that are attached to a baby monitor. The props help him pretend he's taking orders through the phone. Watching him at work, you might think Pierre is a less than friendly vendor. He constantly snaps at customers who dare to ask for a fresco the wrong way. Think the soup Nazi on Seinfeld. That's my fresco you're shaving. He barks at a rattled customer on the fake phone.
If you do not follow the rules, well, it's over for you. You have to go back and do it over again. You just have to learn the system.
But despite all this, it's hard to take Pierre's act seriously. And so the laughter continues. One first-time customer named Jordan thinks Pierre's shtick is just the kind of thing Haitians need right now. It's something that makes people laugh, he says. And I think they're surrounding him like that, just to kind of chase away some of the pain and sadness. As he wheels his rickety boat down the street, the crowd follows, everyone jostling for a better view of Pierre's antics. Most people just call him Catalina, and he gets recognized everywhere he goes.
You know how the president of Haiti is supposed to have connections with the people? Well, the way my business works, I think I have more of a connection with the people than the president of Haiti.
Like many Haitians right now, Pierre lives in a displacement camp, sleeping in a tiny teepee-like structure he built out of sheet metal. But despite his own struggle, he still helps out wherever he can. The day the quake struck, Pierre was selling fresco in the street. He normally charges 60 cents a piece, but the cups were free that day. He quenched thirst while also carting the wounded to the hospital. And even now, he finds little ways to make people feel better.
The kids, the ones without fathers and mothers, they sometimes come and say to me, I'm thirsty, I want something, but I don't have the money. Sometimes, without showing everyone what I'm doing, I give them a little shaved ice on the side. It may not be money, but it's all I have.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
And to see a slideshow of Pierre and his crazy shaved ice cart, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. Reporters like Grant usually stay in cheap hotels or hostels when they're working. But there's even a cheaper way to travel that's becoming popular, and it's not just reporters who are taking advantage of it. Any tourist can couch surf. All you need is a friendly local to invite you in. Will Everett has done it, and he filed this reporter's notebook.
It's not everyone's cup of tea, sleeping on the couch or in the guest room of a stranger. But if you're traveling in a foreign country and looking for the maximum cultural experience, couch surfing is the way to go. Your couch surfing host will not only give you a place to flop, he or she might also show you around and even cook for you. And it's all free. All you have to do is accept the hospitality of a stranger. You just go to the Couchsurfing website, search through the member profiles, email them, and go from there. I've couchsurfed about a dozen times, everywhere from France to Pakistan, and I signed up to be a host myself, though I didn't think there'd be many couchsurfers coming through my part of South Texas. And then I got an email from Brian, who lives in Washington, D.C. He said he and his family were driving through Mexico and would be crossing the border into Texas the following day. He wondered if they could stay in my home. I agreed right away, but then doubts began to surface. I wondered, who are these people anyway? How could I be sure I can trust them? I'm ashamed to say that I even strolled through the house gathering up things of value and stashing them in my closet. It turned out the Hennessys were coming back from an international AIDS conference in Mexico City. They have their own nonprofit organization. Their mission is to get people around the world to talk about AIDS in an open way. Their two daughters, 6 and 8 years old, had met a lot of politicians and celebrities on their recent travels. They showed me pictures of themselves with Teddy Kennedy, Danny Glover, and Annie Lennox. They'd done so much couch surfing over the summer, they knew how to make themselves at home anywhere. They played my piano, went swimming in my pool, and drew pictures that they then hung all over the house. Brian, their father, opened up his laptop in the living room to get some work done while his wife, Radia, got dinner ready in the kitchen. A friend dropped by and, seeing us in action, assumed that we'd all known each other for years. And it sort of felt like we had. The next day, after a last dip in the pool, they loaded up their van and departed. It was hard saying goodbye. After I waved them out of the driveway, I went back inside to find a note from the girls hanging on the fireplace. It said this had been their best couch surfing experience yet. I unloaded all the valuables I'd hidden in my closet, bitterly ashamed of myself. I'd gone around the world relying on the kindness of strangers, but once the shoe was on the other foot, I'd become cagey and mistrustful. I thought about what I'd learned from the Hennessys about their mission of getting people to talk about AIDS. But they'd taught me an even better lesson, the value of trust.
Will Everett is a freelance producer living in Texas. Oliver Mutukudzi is Zimbabwe's most famous and most beloved musician. In his music, he takes on many of the issues that confront Zimbabweans on a daily basis, like the child abuse epidemic we heard about earlier in the show. Ish Mufundikwa is our guide to global music, and he's been listening to Mutukudzi's music for years.
What makes Oliver so popular is that he's singing about us and our everyday experiences, and I think he strikes a chord. That's why he's so big here.
And he's been around for a long time. He was writing music during the Rhodesian regime that was very repressive. And then when Zimbabwe gained its independence, he wrote celebratory music. And now, of course, under Mugabe, he has really helped his fans walk through this difficult period.
Yeah, Oliver has been he's been around forever. He started off in the 70s. And I think his first single, it was just him and his guitar. And then he started singing with a band. And as you rightly say, he's been writing songs about our experiences from those days and also right through independence up to now.
What are the themes he's been writing about? What would be the prevalent themes?
Well, Oliver has always made it a point, made it very clear that he's not a political commentator. He's a musician. And I think that the issue that is really hammered time and time again in his music is the AIDS pandemic. As you know, Zimbabwe is in the middle of the Southern African region, which is the hardest hit in the world. And Oliver has really made a contribution in terms of addressing that particular topic.
What would be one of your favorite songs of Oliver's that has to deal with the AIDS pandemic?
I think Todi is one of the very, very best songs that where he addresses the issue. The Todi is what shall we do?
Oh, Todi, what shall we do?
Tingadi,
Sinzinjan,
what shall we do?
He also refers to marital rape in a way, saying, you know, this it's so painful for a woman to have to give in to having sex with the husband, to be forced into having sex while the husband knows that he's HIV positive.
That's what that song speaks about?
Yeah, that's what it speaks about, and also just asking what shall we do about this very, very, very serious problem that we are facing.
Let's talk about some more of his music that really evokes a sense of Zimbabwe.
Another song that I would say really strikes a chord here in this country is the song called Tozeza Baba, which is we are afraid of our father, because it's about a domestic violence. He's saying our father, besides being a drunk, when he comes home, he also beats up our mother. So these are the sort of issues that Oliver really tries to address in his music.
It's interesting you say that that song is about domestic violence, which is a serious issue in many parts of the world, but certainly in Zimbabwe also. And yet, that's a very depressing topic, but the music is very upbeat. You almost want to dance listening to it. That's interesting, combining those kinds of lyrics with such upbeat music.
I think that's a very African thing. Africans, I think all over the continent, have this thing of, addressing very serious issues to very music that really sounds happy.
Now, who are his fans? Is it young Zimbabweans or people in his generation? Who comes to these concerts mostly?
Right across the board. Young people love Oliver, older people, of course, and but everybody, he sings for and to the people of Zimbabwe, and everybody loves him.
How would people in Zimbabwe, if I were to meet a Zimbabwean on the street and ask about Oliver, how would they describe their most famous musician?
I think a lot of people would just tell you that he has brought a lot of pleasure into their lives, and he talks about their own experiences, and he's a nice guy, a regular guy.
I'd like to close on a song that's popular called Rocky. And first of all, what does Rocky mean?
That's the Shona translation of luck, English, L-U-C-K. But we don't have L in Shona, so it's just Rocky. Oliver is talking about how some people, see their good fortune as being lucky, going through life and saying, well, I've been so lucky. And yet they do not sometimes, or they forget to acknowledge that there might be somebody there who's watching over them.
So does he have a spiritual dimension to his music as well?
Yeah, there is always that underlying element of spirituality, if you will.
Since we recorded this interview, there's been a great tragedy in Oliver Mutukudzi's life. Just a few weeks ago, his 22-year-old son, Sam, was killed in a car accident. Sam was a musical force in his own right in Zimbabwe. He played the guitar and the saxophone, and he often played with his father. The young musician was making a name for himself before he died. Here's a song he wrote called Amai.
Guru
That was Sam Mutakutsi playing his song Amai with his band. Sam died a few weeks ago in Zimbabwe. And that's it for our show this week. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, Building a Better World for Children. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.